But I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for bringing us here to the Åland Island to be able to reflect on the framework, on the Framework Convention and on minority protection more generally. I think I must admit that I'm quite humbled to be able to address such a distinguished audience of so many individuals, of such a collective knowledge and experience in dealing with minority protection that has gathered here. And, of course, such a collective group of individuals that have fought for minority rights for many more years than just the 20 years that we are reflecting here today. So what can I add to this distinguished audience and to the collective wealth of knowledge and experience, as I said? I will try to reflect on the context, so the broader context of nationalism and Europeanization within which minority protection happens or doesn't happen, as it were. And I'll start by saying that no doubt, of course, the Framework Convention has proven a very useful framework, and it is just as relevant today as it was 20 years ago when Europe was going through the processes of nation building and state formation and wars even between and among different ethnicities and different minorities and ethnic groups. But I think that what we've witnessed today is a set of challenges that present or pose, a number of big threats, I would say, to minority protection in general. And I'll try to say a few things about these two processes that are included in my title. First, let me turn to the process of nationalism. I will start by saying that Roger Brubaker was right when he renamed nation states as nationalizing states. For my generation and for the generation of my students that were born after the Framework Convention was brought into being, that were born, of course, after all the wars in the wake of the dissolution of the former Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union, of course, it is hard to believe that the followers will still follow the empty nationalist promises in today's world. And of course, that minorities are still considered as a problem, something that we've learned was an issue in the past throughout the history of the contemporary international community. But as I said, it's hard to believe that this still seems to be the case. And I will here borrow a social constructivist argument to say that perceptions affect, construct our behavior. So if we perceive minorities as a problem, of course this affects the behavior towards minority issues and minority protection as such. In such a context, minority protection is still often guaranteed, if at all, as a top-down process to address the problem, in inverted commas, rather than to guarantee equal human rights of persons belonging to minorities. Any securitization of ethnic issues, identity issues, or minority issues and minorities only reinforces this approach, so a top-down approach to address, possibly resolve this problem. But why is this approach so problematic? It is problematic because it prevents minorities from co-deciding on how to best guarantee their rights and protect their interests, legitimate interests, as states would say. This prevents effective participation of minorities, persons belonging to them, in carrying out minority protection, so in enjoying minority rights. This has, and I think this is important, at least two very problematic unintended consequences or side effects, as it were. And I'll call them, and then briefly discuss both of them, I'll call them statism and homogenization, the latter point being addressed already a little bit by Francesco, and I'd like to build on that. So with respect to statism, minority protection is way too often perceived by states as a static, never-changing set of norms, rights, and as states adopted their laws and sometimes constitutions with respect to the newly formed states, minority protection was set up for them once and for all. States are not sensitive to the constant need to manage diversity, including through minority protection as a dynamic set of norms. The advisory committee would call the Framework Convention as a flexible approach, as a pragmatic but principled approach towards minority protection. And this is something that doesn't come across so frequently due to this static focus on minority protection as it was established some 20 or 25 years ago. So statism is also reflected in the scope of application of minority protection. And here the advisory committee also has approached the issue by looking and drafting the next thematic report on the scope of application. And here I think what is important that we remind ourselves how useful, again, the Framework Convention is with its Article 6 and with the possibility for several other individuals to be included in the scope of application of the Framework Convention in different forms. Now I'll turn to the process of homogenization, as already mentioned by Francesco. So I think that's the second side effect of this top-down approach by looking at minorities as a problem. In order for minorities to enjoy minority rights and to affect the actual rights that they are would like to enjoy and sort of are useful for them to be able to preserve their different identity, so to effectively enjoy their rights, they often need to homogenize. So they need to speak with one voice in such a difficult circumstances. But this is contrary to how democracy and life in general functions. We live in societies that are fundamentally diverse in so many different ways. So to expect from minorities to homogenize, speak with one voice, goes really contrary to not just the human nature, but also to the very essence of democracy, which is one of the cornerstones in the context of minority protection. Such a homogenization, of course, goes at the expense, as I've said, of in-group diversity, of ignoring the in-group diversity, different views, different needs. And, of course, it further reinforces the perception of minorities as presenting this problem that I mentioned in the beginning. And in the context of homogenization, Francesco already mentioned that is, of course, this idea that you are what you are and that you have a unidimensional identity, which is, again, contrary to what we see in the actual world. So the statism and homogenization are the two side effects, I would say the unintended consequences of nationalism that is so problematic. And on top of that, nationalism, I think, seems to be on the rise. And it seems to be on the rise and sort of like promoted in the context of three other developments that I think we all need to reflect when we are thinking about minority protection in the context, at the crossroads, as the conference suggests. The first such stimulus to nationalism is definitely presented, of course, in the context of the Ukrainian crisis that was mentioned earlier. The second stimulus is, of course, due to the economic crisis that, again, sort of stimulates these nationalist ideas that are so hard to believe to many of us, and I said to younger generations even more so. And the third stimulus comes from the post-conflict societies, where I think we need to notice that transitional justice has not been completed at all. First, democratic elections cemented the nationalist political parties in power, and relatively small events, such as some statements by recently elected presidents in the region that I come from, of course, sometimes send overly sensitive messages across the border that are being reflected for the reasons, I think, that sort of put us back in this transitional justice context that has not been completed, as I've said. That brings me to my second broad context, the context of Europeanization. And here, a number of issues also present quite substantive challenges to minority protection in the contemporary world and in Europe in particular. So minority protection has been understood right from the beginning, following the end of the Cold War, as a set of Europe-wide norms, as a joint European goal, a joint European project. But firstly, we need to notice that these past 20 years, certainly, or a quarter of a century, have demonstrated that it is not a truly Europe-wide goal. And the lack of progress in the Framework Convention ratifications, also mentioned by Francesco earlier on, needs to be noted here. And secondly, the momentum for minority protection in the context of EU enlargement has been by and large lost, with perhaps some small exceptions. This is the case because, firstly, the EU is unsure about its enlargement strategy, and secondly, because not all potential candidates are as eager as the Central and European countries were some 15 years ago. In the context of Bosnia-Herzegovina, for example, it seems that the country is not willing to lose its others on the way towards the EU membership. And even Bosnians, so people who are embracing the civic identity, are not capable and able to participate in the political life of the country. But the context of Europeanization needs some further discussion, which often is not appreciated by the European Union, but is certainly crucial for minority protection, and particularly for minority protection at the crossroads. Firstly, minority protection as a political criterion was applied for the outsiders. This created a perception of double standards. Some states had to change legislation because they had national minorities. And, of course, this again reinforced the perception of minorities being a problem. But other states, at the same time, most of them in the West, still have no minorities, or so they say. So minority protection was instrumentalized for other goals. Firstly, it was instrumentalized to gain international recognition, and then secondly, it was instrumentalized to gain membership in international organizations, such as the Council of Europe or the European Union. And secondly, the Europeanization of minority protection was definitely poorly monitored, and it was assessed based on legislation rather than actual minority rights to be enjoyed by persons belonging to minorities. The literature will tell us that there was no emphasis on the so-called process of deep socialization, so the actual internalization of the norms, which would lead then to appropriate behavior, but that the focus was very much on the legislation, so on ticking the boxes, as it were, rather than on the change of the behavior. And I think here the Council of Europe and the monitoring bodies, such as the Advisory Committee or the Committee of Experts or ECRI, have a huge comparative advantage, but also a huge task, so that they can go to the countries, they can engage with persons belonging to minorities, and they can monitor how the norms were actually implemented in practice, because this is what minority protection is all about. And thirdly, Europeanization was based on an idea in the beginning of minority protection. In the beginning, even without some concrete norms, only gradually it was based on the Framework Convention. But it wasn't fully embraced, as it seems. So the Europeanizing agents, I would absolutely argue, lacked credibility, and that all presented, again, a number of challenges for the effectiveness of minority protection in practice. Now, that brings me to my short conclusion. So where do we go from here in this very complex context of nationalism and Europeanization? And I had the time and the ability just to reflect on these two processes and some of the side effects that we need to pay attention to. So firstly, I would say that minority protection definitely needs to be seen as a process, as a dynamic set of norms that offer opportunities for dealing with the actual diversities in societies. And here I would not like to repeat what already Francesco said earlier. And secondly, I think what is needed in this complex context is, I would argue that minority protection needs a new eager European champions, a new friends of minority protection that would lead the way, that would pave the way, something similar that was happening in the early 1990s. And I think if actors, both states, international institutions, but also individuals, if they sort of took the momentum and showed the way that this could be a step forward. Because I think, as again Francesco mentioned, how many times can you repeat the same message? So perhaps there is an opportunity at a crossroads that several issues are being shown to others, and hopefully the others will follow now in this respect in the right direction, as it were. And in the end, what I think I can say is that, of course, experts and for sure the advisory committee will continue to convince states that minority protection is in their interests. So it's in our joint common interests. And I would like to thank you now for your attention, and I look forward to your comments and to the discussion later today. Thank you.